the CBSE and ICSE assessment criteria for the Class 12 board exams. That's because there are no board exams this year because of the COVID situation. In a very important decision, the government decided that it was important to ensure that students are well in this COVID scenario, and therefore there is a very elaborate formula. It was presented to the Supreme Court, which has said that the boards need to go ahead and prepare for this. So it's accepted. 40% of the marks will be based on Class 12, on the exams in Class 12, the pre-board test as well. 30% of the marks are based on the Class 11 final exam. 30% of the marks are based on the best of three Class 10 marks. And practical marks will be based on actuals. The CBSE will declare Class 12 results on the 31st of July. The CISE has told the Supreme Court the Class 12 results will be out before the 31st of July. Students who want to appear in exams will get an opportunity. And the Supreme Court to this has said that the CBSE and the CISE can finalize and notify the scheme. So finally, there is clarity. Joining us now, Dr. Jagpreet Singh, the headmaster of Dhoon School, Dehradun. Dr. Sudha Acharya will be with us as well in a moment. Professor Anita Rampal, professor and former Dean of Faculty of Education, Delhi University. We've got Dr. Shaini Matthew, the principal of Jawahar Central School in Kerala. And we've got a couple of bright students. We've got Mannat Ahmed Khan, a Class 12 student. And we have got Zenith, a Class 12 student as well. In fact, let me come to the students first, because this is actually about them. Aman, let me come to you first. You're a Class 12 student of Modern School, Vasant Vihar. Are you relieved that there's clarity now?
For sure. I think this is a big relief that we've now understood that what our evaluation criteria is going to be like. It's definitely a big relief for all of our students, because, you know, if we want to apply to universities, we were waiting to hear back
yes.
On what the evaluation criteria is going to be like, and now we can finally apply. But one concern that a lot of us have is that in 11th grade, we had new subjects that were given to us, so not a lot of us were able to perform that well. And 11th as a class is historically a class where students see a dip. So I think students would be more relieved if, just like 10th, where 3 out of 5 scores are being taken, even in 11th, 3 out of 5 scores are taken.
Okay. Zenith, your sense of, you know, this pie chart, as it were, of how you're going to be assessed, do you like it? Is it okay for you? Zenith, I think you're on mute. Can you unmute yourself?
Yeah, sorry for that.
Go ahead.
For me, I think it's a reasonable, you know, criteria for assessment. But while we're all digging into, you know, the weightage that has been given to the Class 10th, 11th and 12th exams that have taken place, we need to remember at the first place that many of us didn't have internet access for the entire, you know, duration of the pandemic. So before getting into how well our result is going to be, we should also focus on all those who didn't have access, who haven't even taken classes. So there's right. a very cause for concern for those students.
That's a very important point, and it's a very generous point for a young student like you to make. Dr. Jagpreet Singh, that is such an important point. You know, children will be evaluated for Class 12. Many of these children haven't been to school in Class 12. It's an online education. You know, there are poor students over here who can't even afford a smartphone, let alone, you know, anything else, internet access. So is this really fair?
Thank you for this question, but, you know, my view is different. We have tried to cut fit all. And this is very unfortunate, because of what I hear the two ladies speak right now before me. But when the countries, when the universities abroad are going for predicted grades, we are going for historical data. I just don't simply understand. I mean, why in 10th class have they taken the three subjects? And those three subjects are not the subjects what they're doing in class 11 and 12. They're only going on the highest marks, you know, in any subject. Now that 11 and 12 is a diploma course, that's a 2-year course. I think 11 and 12 makes a little bit of a sense, but then try to understand the child when was sitting there for the exam did not know that the 11th criteria would be taken in class 12. And normally it's a home exam and people do not put that much of an effort. But then in class 12, we are a little strict with marking, even till the pre-boards, because we presume that we have to be a little more strict so that they earn a better mark in the board exam. Now, taking that evaluation and getting it to the criteria of a percentage, and also being mindful that we are taking the skill sets of class 10, 11, and 12 to the same level. The maturity levels have grown from class 10 to 12. And mind you, when we are talking about the 12th class grades, we are keeping a very large percentage, that is 60%, out of the 12th class. We are taking 30% of the 10th and 30% of the 11th.
Yeah, correct.
Where 40% only for the 12th class. That is a concern. The 12th class is the year where the child puts a maximum effort so that he can go and apply into the university. Now the predicted grades have already gone to the universities. They are waiting for the marks to be uploaded. And suppose they have a disrupted mark, I mean, it's going to ask for the seats to be resented. I mean, they are going to cancel their seats, the conditional admissions in the universities. So
Dr.
there
Acharya,
is a concern.
All right. So you very, very important point. Dr. Acharya, the other point that strikes me is that different schools in different parts of the country have different systems, styles of evaluation, different standards of assessment. A unit test may not even have the same curriculum. Some may be easier, some may be tougher, some may not even have had it. So then how do you actually, say that benchmark it all together?
Yeah, let me start with a system that one solution doesn't fit all. But the committee has tried to give us a very inclusive and comprehensive policy. I'll just take some time to explain the policy, why class 10th. Class 10th is the only differentiator, because that is the only standardized valid examination in normal time this batch has taken. And why the best of three subjects? Suppose I do not like Hindi, I do not like SST, I do not want to pursue, so I may not have done well. But my three best subjects, if I have aptitude, if I have interest, I have scored well. So this is child-centric to give the maximum benefit to the child. Class 10, best three averages taken. Why class 11? Earlier, we were also not in favor, like the child was saying. In class 11, mostly children are engaged in exploration, research, other activities. They are never focused on exam only, as they are focused in class 12. But as I understood, there are schools which are residential. Children went to native places. There are KVs where children went to native places. Due to huge digital divide, we could not reach out to them. So most of them, either they have taken one unit test of class 12 or one of the test, or some of them have not taken class 12. It was very difficult because the second wave affected all our life. It was highly disruptive, and we can call it a black swan event. So the reaction is just like that also. So class 12, in the absence of conducting exam, that's why the class 11th is taken, because the syllabus and curriculum is in continuum.
Right.
But as sir said, that in class 12, suppose my best average is English, Math, Science, but I am going for Commerce or Humanities. These subjects I will not pursue at all. You know, I
yes.
may improve upon my score in 11, 12, because 10 children are very small, and 12th is a gateway for their future path, their career path. But 10th is the only discriminator, only standardized exam. As you have already yourself said, that the school-based examination and internal assessment, everything was done online. So it doesn't truly reflect the actual performance of the child, what we have seen. So for that, even some of the schools like us, we give very strict marking in 11th and 12th pre-board, thinking that students will improve upon in board exam. So that's why it will never come to the near, and it cannot be a perfect substitute of the actual assessment done by conducting pre-board
exams. No, quite right.
It is just by statistical approximation we are trying to.
And so how is that fair in a situation like this? But let me take this to Dr. Shaini Matthew, the principal of Jawahar Central School in Kerala. What are your views on this, ma'am? There is a set of concerns that there will be so much of a leeway that when the final grades come out, that you'll end up with any number of students scoring 100% overall, and the college system will be completely overwhelmed. On the other hand, lots of points over here saying that some students are assessed differently than others. The other students haven't even attended class 12 because of the situation.
All right.
So your thoughts?
Okay. Okay, greetings from Kerala. Yeah, let me tell you that CBSE have come out with an excellent strategy, criteria of calculating the marks. And we can assure that CBSE has worked meticulously, and the way that they have asked us to calculate will help the students to get their deserved marks. We are very sure about it. Because the 10th standard, we were all worried, parents were worried, students were worried, but the criteria that the CBSE board had brought, we were able to do excellently well, and the children, all those who are supposed to get their 95%, they will never go down to 75, but they will be getting their deserving marks 95 itself. And those who got 75, they will never go up to 95. Because they'll be getting their right marks. That is the way the criteria was. So in 12th standard also, children do not have to worry, the parents do not have to worry. CBSE have come up with the right criteria, and in an excellent way, we will be able to calculate their marks. And I'm very sure that people from Kerala, we were all working on it, and then we are very happy. And to,
okay. So you are happy with what has happened. School, all right, ma'am.
The society that we don't have to worry. We are
okay,
very happy.
So I just want to go across to Professor Anita Rampal. Professor Rampal, do you believe that if at all possible, there should be some system of testing students in entrance exams before they enter colleges, because the system of the class 12 results, you know, it results in several questions being raised. I'm not sure there was a better formula available. Perhaps there was, perhaps there wasn't. But in terms of having a uniform standard for admission to colleges, do you think tests should be made compulsory?
I think that this should have been done long back. A school leaving should remain a school leaving exam, not linked with university entrance. And so university and college entrances should really be different and more specific in terms of what they're looking for and which students, you know, what students' abilities they want to actually give a premium to. So I think that should evolve, and that should really have been done much earlier, because this has become quite a farce, you know. Getting 99 and 100% marks and then coming to university is, and boards vying with each other to give more marks, it doesn't really assess students very meaningfully. But I think what now has been done rather late, because even this should have been done at least 3 months before today. When we saw that the surge was coming, and the students should not have faced such uncertainty and such deep, deep, acute anxieties. So I think looking at all the disparities in which various students find themselves, some completely not having the, you know, inequities in digital accessibility and in having digital devices in the home, having connectivity, not having had many classes, been able to access many classes in the last year. I think this is a fair enough system to give them, assess them over the past 3 years,
right,
and to give them the best possible marks that they have acquired in the last 3 years.
Okay. We've got another student, Mannat Ahmed Khan. Mannat, what do you think about this? Does this work for you, the way you're going to be evaluated?
I think personally, this is a good criteria, but the consequences are a little different, because ultimately the pre-board exams that we give and the 11th examinations are practice tests. They are considerably difficult from our board examinations, and they are marked more strictly. So those marks don't really reflect how hard we could have worked in our board examinations and how well we could have scored in them. So I think that will, first of all, affect college cutoffs. And I think the board, CBSE, should be a little lenient when they consider, because our 10th, 11th, 12th pre-board marks and normal examinations will not be up to mark of how we could have performed in our grade 12 board examinations.
Yeah. I think all the teachers here would agree that we've got three extremely articulate young students, and hopefully they will get a real chance at a realistic grade. I'd like to thank you all very much for joining us. We need to take a short break. There's more coming up. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Left, Right and Center. In just a little while from now, we'll be playing out that interview with Jairam Ramesh, the senior Congress leader, on his new book, also Key Questions on the Leadership of the Party. The fact that the party is in turmoil, what's the way forward? That's coming up. You don't want to miss that interview. But today's also been, we've also seen an important report by the Reserve Bank of India on this stage of where the economy presently lies, the way out as India fights COVID. 2 lakh crore loss is to the economy has taken place from the second wave alone. And the point that they're saying is that the speed and scale of vaccination needs to be upped so that the economy can recover. This wave has fanned into smaller cities and villages, and it's sapped rural demand. That's key. Without rural demand, the overall state of the economy badly impacted. Support from government spending may also be moderate from extraordinary expansion undertaken last year. In a situation like this, how much can the government spend? It really does need to be asked, because there is, over the last 1 year, we've seen the government announce several schemes to try and step up the economy, improve the economy, but that second wave really did hit us hard. How much can the government continue to spend to increase economic activity overall? Increased spread of COVID-19 infections in rural areas clearly poses a risk. The economy does have the resilience and the fundamentals to bounce back from the pandemic. So that's some good news over there, which the RBI says can unshackle itself from pre-existing cyclic and structural hindrances. But how exactly is that going to take place? The pace of the recovery will depend on the speed of vaccination. We've mentioned this earlier on, so it really does go back to that key point. Inflation does merit close watching. As we mentioned to you, fuel inflation in the country is presently at very high levels. And even though we haven't seen so much of that inflation in other areas, there is a fear that there could be a cascading impact going forward. The price of petrol today, for example, in Ganganagar in Rajasthan, was 109 rupees. So that's unbelievably high. So inflation does clearly merit close watching. And it's a shock to the economy, which has mainly been to demand. So demand has been badly affected in a situation like this. Agriculture and contactless services are indeed holding up. So that's some good news and evidence of a positive momentum in industrial production as well. Obviously, a long way to go. India needs to avoid a third wave, not just in order to save lives, which is obviously the most important, but also to give us direction and to shape our economy for real growth to return. We are going to move on now, take a quick look at that interview with Jairam Ramesh. The book, The Light of Asia, which is a narrative of the life of Lord Buddha, is widely regarded a seminal work of the 19th century, a masterpiece on the historiography of modern Buddhism. The poem, The Light of Asia, by Sir Edwin Arnold, was published in 1879 in London and came to greatly influence Jairam Ramesh. This is the cover of Mr. Ramesh's book. It came to influence him as a teenager. The ideas of The Light of Asia have always been a part of Jairam Ramesh's life. He's now published this book. It's called The Light of Asia, the poem that defined the Buddha. The book is a biography of the epic bio-poem on the Buddha. Jairam Ramesh is also, of course, a key insider in the Congress at a time when the party is widely seen to be in turmoil. We hope to speak to him not just about the book, but about the Congress as well. But first, on to the book. Why did you decide to throw fresh light on who Sir Edwin Arnold was, how his life unfolded, his relationship with India, and why he came to write The Light of Asia in the first place?
Well, Vishnu, I read this poem many, many years ago when I was a teenager, and it remained with me. But subsequently, I discovered a correspondence between Winston Churchill and Jawaharlal Nehru with frequent references to The Light of Asia. And of course, at the height of the agitation on Ayodhya, I could not but help recall the 70-year-old agitation that we had for the control of the Mahabodhi temple at Bodh Gaya between Hindu organizations and Buddhist organizations, which was triggered by the publication of Edwin Arnold's poem, The Light of Asia. I couldn't find a better way of spending the lockdown last year than to revisit this epic poem that was first published in 1879 and that went on to define the life of the Buddha for generations of people, not only in England, but also in America, in Europe, and most importantly, right, of course, in our own country.
Now, the book had a huge influence on at least 11 literary personalities from around the world. 5 of them were Nobel laureates. What was the essence of the book, if not the book, the message that was so influential?
Vishnu, it had influence on Ramakrishna Paramahamsa in a Bengali translation. It had influence on Vivekananda, on Gandhi, on Nehru, of course on Tagore, and on Ambedkar himself. Now, I think the reason why the book became a sensation, and the reason why the book has remained a sensation, a literary sensation and a cultural sensation, is because it focuses on the humanity of Buddha, not on the divinity of Buddha. We are obsessed and fixated, with divinity. But we, in our fixation and obsession with divinity, we tend to overlook common humanity. And I think this poem really brought out the humanity of Buddha, his compassion, his tolerance, his understanding, his message that, be your own seeker. After all, the Buddha didn't become the Buddha by following a Buddha. He basically told people that search for yourself, look for yourself. But most importantly, of course, he rejected orthodoxy and orthopraxy.
Right.
That's why social reformers in different parts of India, Narayana Guru, for example, in Kerala, Eyothi Thas and Lakshmi Narasu in Tamil Nadu, and of course, Dr. Ambedkar himself, all derived inspiration from this message of the Buddha, which was a rejection of the caste system, which was the very foundation of our society, and unfortunately, it remains one of the foundations.
Ramesh, you referred to that exchange between Churchill to Nehru, and the context is fascinating because Nehru spent over a decade of his life in jail, and yet you had Churchill still writing to him, and this was a quote which was interesting. Yours is indeed a heavy burden and responsibility, shaping the destiny of your many millions of countrymen and playing your outstanding part in world affairs. I wish you well in your task. Remember the light of Asia. It's fascinating that Churchill would actually refer to the book as well.
Well, Churchill was a great admirer of Rudyard Kipling, and one of the great influences on Rudyard Kipling, very early influence on Rudyard Kipling, and the man who nominated Rudyard Kipling for the Nobel Prize in Literature was none other than Edwin Arnold himself. Nehru, of course, like Gandhi, like Tagore, like Vivekananda, was a cultural Buddhist. He was a great believer in the life of the Buddha. They were not Buddhists by any chance, but they were greatly fascinated by the life of the Buddha. Ambedkar, on the other hand, saw the political message of Buddha. He saw the message of caste equality, the breaking down of caste barriers. This was the essential part of Buddha. And in fact, the book that Ambedkar wrote finally, which was published after his death, was called The Buddha and His Dhamma. And as you know, in October 1956, Ambedkar and lakhs of his followers became Buddhists. So for Ambedkar, like Dharmanand Kosambi before him, Buddha was a political figure. Whereas for Vivekananda, for Tagore, for Gandhi, for Nehru, and for a host of many others, Buddha was a cultural phenomenon. Not only influenced the subcontinent, but of course influenced large parts of Asia and large parts of the world. Also, Vishnu, embedded in this biography of the Light of Asia is the life of Edwin Arnold himself.
Right.
And Edwin Arnold translated the Bhagavad Gita into English, called the Song Celestial.
Despite being somebody who believed very strongly in the civilizational role of the British.
Absolutely.
In India.
So he was a Victorian imperialist,
yeah.
A believer in Britain's destiny in India. But Mahatma Gandhi first got introduced to the Bhagavad Gita when he was very young, a student in London, through the English translation of Edwin Arnold, called the Song Celestial. And right till he was assassinated, this remained one of his favorite books. And this is a book that he would recommend to his family, to his friends, to his colleagues, to people who would write to him, asking him what his life was all about. And he would quote from the from the Song Celestial. So the Song Celestial was also very influential. And of course, earlier, Arnold had translated the Hitopadesha. He had translated the Gita Govinda. and he had translated the Mahabharata. So this is a two-in-one biography. It's a biography of a poem, of an epic poem, but it's also a biography of the poet who happened to be a great popularizer of Indian literature, Sanskrit literature, even as he believed in the Britain's destiny in the Indian subcontinent.
Now, Mr. Ramesh, you know, I'm not going to let you go without asking you a couple of political questions. We've been trying to speak to you for a while, and so I really must ask you a couple of things, particularly in the context of the series of losses in state polls, where the Congress presently stands. Recently, you've lost another leader. Jitin Prasad has left the Congress to join the BJP. Why are leaders deserting the Congress?
Well, obviously, you know, they're looking for greener pastures. The people who have left us, particularly the youngsters who have left us, clearly, you know, looking for the loaves of office. They have been privileged. They're privileged by birth. They've been privileged by the party. They've been given responsible positions. But clearly, they do not have the fire in their belly to remain in the opposition. But I can assure you that for every Sindhia and for every Jitin Prasada who has left, there are thousands of youngsters, young men and women across the country in the Congress party fighting for the Congress. These are not easy times. We face a ruthless, relentless and remorseless BJP. These are extraordinarily difficult circumstances for us. We are not in power at the center. We are in power on our own in only three states. But in spite of this, let me just finish 1 minute. In spite of this, you know, there are thousands of youngsters who have committed their lives to working for the Congress Party and its organization and its ideology.
You know, you just used the phrase privileged by birth, but then, you know, that is the central criticism of the BJP and others on the Congress, that it's being privileged by birth that has resulted in the
accepting?
Congress leadership.
Why is it accepting
being in a situation which has left them, which is untenable at many levels?
Yeah, but why is it accepting them? You know, as long as they're in the Congress, they criticize, and when they leave the Congress, they embrace them. So, you know, I'm just saying that people who have been privileged by the party with positions of authority, positions of power, given ministerial berths, made members of parliament, they owe something to the party, you know. A political party is an expression of your conviction, of your beliefs. These are not things that you just shed, like you change your kurta every day. You don't change parties every other day, depending on whether a party is in power or not. Now, I'm not minimizing the challenges that the Congress faces. We face multiple challenges.
No, but Mr. Ramesh, perhaps the biggest challenge that you face is a challenge of leadership. The fact that you've got 20 plus senior leaders writing into the leadership, in many cases not getting appointments, some of your senior most leaders being sort of kept outside the fray, being out in the wilderness in a sense, younger leaders leaving the party, in a situation when the Congress has clearly failed to convey its message since 2014.
No, I think, who's
responsible for this?
Whatever debates and whatever questions have to be raised within party forums. You know, there is a certain discipline to a party. It cannot be a free-for-all. It's not a railway platform where people come and people go. There are party forums. Now, I agree that we must expand the footprint of these party forums. We must have more forums where people speak at the district level, at the state level, at the national level. But I think these are debates that take place within the party. These are issues that get raised within the party. And I can assure you, my own experience has been the Congress remains the most democratic organization. People have different points of view. We have a consensus. We don't necessarily have unanimity. And we express our points of view. I myself have expressed points of view which are contrary sometimes to the views taken by the leadership or the party. But I've expressed it in party forums. I've made my point. But once the party has taken a position, I think you can't keep second-guessing your party all the time for personal advantage. There is a certain thing called a party position. You may like it, you may not like it.
Right, but again, you know, on the central issue of leadership, right? Parties need leaders who reflect a certain changed reality. This isn't to suggest that they're good for the party or bad for the party, politics is dynamic. And in this scenario, when there are question marks on the leadership of the Congress, not now, but for several years, and you could be a great open democratic party. No one is saying denying that. And I appreciate what you're saying about there being more forums perhaps required to voice that democracy. But where is this democracy led in terms of your leadership?
No, people are free to express their views. People are constantly expressing their views. I have been party to meetings and, meetings within the party organization where different points of view have been expressed. And finally, a consensus view has emerged. And we follow that consensus view. Now, if you're asking me, if you're telling me we need to resolve the leadership issue one way or the other, yeah, I agree. I mean, these are issues that we should not keep hanging for too long. We have, we lost badly in 2014. We lost very, very badly in 2019. And we have to get our house in order. House in order means getting the organization in order, getting the leadership in order, getting our messaging in order. All this has to move. But, to reduce the party to a matter of one individual or two individuals, I don't think any one individual or two individuals or three individuals have magic wands. This is a collective effort.
Okay.
It's a gigantic collective effort in which we all play a part. We have to, in my view, you really have to look at the larger collective interest of the party rather than to look at your own individual interests.
So, given the state that you're in now, given what we've seen in the last assembly elections, in the future, will the Congress be agreeable to, say, vacating the leadership role of the UPA to a regional party, in order to forge larger unity in the opposition?
I think this question of vacation and all, these are all, whether it's vacation or vocation or, these are very premature issues. I mean, it's very clear that
why is it premature?
What is clear is we have to work with like-minded parties. We have to have a positive, constructive pre-poll agenda. The United Front was a post-poll alliance. The UPA was a post-poll alliance. But we have to have a common understanding with like-minded parties before the elections, before the 2024 elections, of the type that we have had in different states of the country. And this agenda has not only to be an oppositional agenda to the BJP, but also it has to be a positive, constructive, proactive agenda, which clearly spells out an alternative. I think, who will lead this grouping? Who should lead these groups? These are all premature issues.
Aren't you running out of time in terms of attempting to defeat the strongest political entity that we've seen perhaps in decades? If there is no leader, if there is no face, if there is no consensus, with so many of the opposition parties having serious problems with the Congress itself, then how does one forge that alliance?
That's a huge exaggeration because I think like-minded parties have come together. The Congress party has met with like-minded parties on more than one occasion in Parliament, outside Parliament. At times, the Congress party has taken the position taken by its like-minded parties. At times, the like-minded parties have followed the Congress's leadership. I think leadership is give and take.
Okay.
And the fact is that the Congress party is the only party with a national footprint. We are not a regional party.
No, but, I understand that. And I must ask you about two specific issues, the issue of Punjab and the leadership issue over there and dissent within the party.
Since I am not involved with these specific issues, I mean, it's better that, you ask the people who are directly concerned. Isn't the BJP facing a problem in Karnataka?
Right.
Isn't the BJP facing a problem in Uttar Pradesh? Isn't the BJP facing a problem in Madhya Pradesh? See, the problems of the Congress becomes media fodder. And the problems within the BJP somehow seem to hardly get the same amount of media prominence and commentariat attention as the problems of the Congress party.
Final question, Sachin Pilot in Rajasthan and problems over there which have persisted for so long. These are two states, Punjab and Rajasthan, you've got problems in both.
Sachin is a fine young man with a long and glorious political future in the Congress party. I'm sure he'll be, whatever gets worked out will be to his advantage. I mean, he's a great asset to us, and he will remain an asset to us.
All right, Mr. Ramesh, thank you so much for, you know, taking all of these questions, and congratulations on this fantastic book. I have gone through a large part of it. The Light of Asia, the poem that defined the Buddha, besides anything else, the most iconic aspect of Buddha's life was peace. Perhaps we need to reflect on that in the present context that we find ourselves in. Thank you, sir, very much for being with us.
Thank you.